Hello, everyone. It is Evola Day. Hope you have been enjoying it. On this video, we're going to be looking at 10 quotations from Evola that I've picked out. And I'm joined by Evelyn. Say hello, Evelyn.
Hello.
And Twitter superstar, Aaron McIntyre. Say hello, Aaron.
How's it going?
And we could also be joined by Furious Pertinax, also known as the Pastor Aussie soon. But he is Italian, and he did say he was making coffee, so he could be like half an hour, as far as we know. So what we're going to do on this one, just to get to know Evola a bit more, is to have a look at these quotations I picked out and then talk about, you know, just react to them essentially, and, you know, unpack what he's saying and whether we agree with it. So this one is from Revolt Against the Modern World, what many people regard as his masterpiece. And he says, "The increasing growth in world population has the same meaning as the swarming of worms on a decomposing organism or as the spreading of cancerous cells. Cancer is an uncontrolled hypertrophy of a plasma that devours the normal differentiated structures of an organism after subtracting itself from the organism's regulating laws. This is the scenario facing the modern world. The regression and the decline of fecundinating, in the higher sense of the term, forces, and the forces that bear forms parallels the unlimited proliferation of matter, of what is formless, of the masses." So I thought this was a particularly interesting passage. You've got to remember he's writing this book in 1934 in fascist Italy, at a time when both in Italy and in Germany and elsewhere, the government was promoting more women to have more and more babies, if you remember. I'm not quite sure if Mussolini had that policy, but there was a great worry about needing enough people to grow the economy. And, you know, I think you could get the Iron Cross in Germany if you had 8 children. And Evola's basically saying, like, underpopulation is not an issue. The issue is this, like, proliferation of the mass man. And, you know, as an aristocratic, elitist, traditionalist, you should actually stand against this. And I included this because I thought it was kind of interesting that he recognizes that the proliferation of the masses only ever leads in one direction. And I guess this, if you want to draw in your elite theorists, you know, Sam Francis talks about the problem of mass and scale.
I think it's the revolution of mass and scale.
Yeah, the revolution of mass and scale.
What I was going to say is, yeah, the just sort of general notion that as society grows, there must be orders that get sort of truncated downwards, but spread sort of ever wider.
Yeah. Any thoughts on this one, Aaron?
Well, it's interesting because it seems to, in many ways, contradict directly someone like Spengler, right, who says that a civilization which is focused on, like, controlling the number of children it has or negotiating the number of children it has is kind of doomed, right? That's one of his big points. And so in many ways, this is very modernist of Evola, right? He's wanting to control, you know, he's saying that you shouldn't just be procreating for the, you know, to procreate, that the people of the civilization should not be having children just to have children. In some ways, I feel like that, you know, these two are clashing pretty heavily.
Yeah, no, what's interesting about that is that he's not saying don't have kids, although interestingly, Evola himself did not have children, never got married. What he's saying is that if the if you're getting to a point where you're having to, the government is having to give incentives to have more kids, right? That this is an altogether kind of backwards way of looking at the problem. And what are you doing? Like, what, for what point? Children for its own sake, just to do what? There is, if you actually look at the section I've taken this from, there is a racial element to this as well, where he's saying, like, well, you know, look at the massive explosion of population in the third world as well. But to what end? You know, can this lead anywhere good?
But I think Spengler's point would be that to consider the end is the problem, right? I think that was kind of where Spengler was going with his point on this, is that once a civilization is thinking about managing it, thinking about pros and cons when it comes to reproduction, it's already kind of entering into this, you know, death spiral. I understand, like I said, before we started, I've not read Evola outside of that one essay, so I don't have the context for both of these. I'm just taking them as I'm reading them. So there might be much more specific things surrounding it, like you're talking about, but just looking at that and just contrasting with other authors I've read, it's just interesting that they seem to be coming from very different angles.
Yeah, I mean, and there is something else to say on this. I think Furious has joined us. Want to say hello, sir?
Oh, yes, indeed. Hello, everyone, and thank you for the invite. AI, much appreciated. My favorite Italian.
Yeah, your favorite Italian. There is one other aspect of Evola's thinking that is kind of... everybody thinks like traditional. I think a lot of people's minds go to the 1950s and the kind of bourgeois family. Evola was very, very anti-bourgeois and in his orientation. And that included the bourgeois reverence for the 2.4 family as well. As an example, I think his reasoning for never getting married or having kids was literally because he did not want to be a bourgeois, which sounds a bit ridiculous. He also in university, even though he was had very high grades and things, refused to graduate or complete his studies because he did not want to take any titles, because he thought that was very bourgeois as well, like to be called doctor or to try to like rest on profession as a mark of status. So this is also part of his thinking as well, which we should be aware of.
It's almost as if Evola identified like an ersatz or a vacuous sort of false status that comes with having letters before and after your name that aren't actually in any way emblematic or symbolic of an actual transcendence of man.
Yeah, and his view of this kind of and you have to remember the conservatism of this era and the views of the fascists and the mid-century Germans as well when he's writing things like this. I think he just thinks that this idea of we must propagate for the sake of it, and that this is somehow, the Germans would have done it under the, like, you know, for the glory of the nation or for the brotherhood or whatever. These days they justify immigration because of GDP. I mean, they literally say we need more immigrants for the economy, right? And this is really what he's getting at here, is it's the fact that for the industrial scale manufacture of more and more stuff, you also need more and more people. And I do find it interesting, actually, that coming back to my old libertarian days and classical liberalism and so on, they always make that argument that we're not running out of space. They're always against overpopulation arguments, that you could fit the entire world into Texas type thing. But I find that interesting. Like, why do they instinctively, why from a pro-capitalist point of view must you instinctively ward off against overpopulation arguments? Well, because there's a logic to wanting to grow the population all the time.
But there's part of that, you know, so much of the context of all is speaking in is about the sort of the march of history kind of narrative and the very sort of material aspects that people take out of those narratives. So even in that time of the progressive era, it was framed in that sense to the individual that they can start their 2.4 children family. And Evola's not even necessarily considering that. He's just skipping straight to seeing humans as sort of operating as a biomass to just sort of fulfill a purpose, and every once in a while, either a higher or a lower purpose.
Yeah, it's almost like the flesh component of the global economy. Like, humankind is reduced to being barcoded and weighed in flesh and their ability to consume.
Yeah, I also think there's a recognition, and bear in mind that he was trying to get to something that we describe as more medieval or more feudal or a kind of a different structure of things. And I think a lot of people have talked about this recently, right? This is not just, this is kind of in the air of our kind of discourse at the moment. I think he's recognizing that you can't get back to his vision wouldn't be Trump done, but it would be, you know, it would be an older order, something like the way that Europe looked under the Holy Roman Empire, for example. You can't really get back to that if you have masses as you know, millions and millions and millions of people. It only works with a smaller scale society, right?
The Italians, ironically, or not ironically, but the Italians have a phraseology for something like this, and the Italians call it campinalismo. And for those who are switched on to etymology, a campo basically means a field, but campinale in the full sense of the word is the, so like the bell tower steeple that sits upon a church. And anyone who's traveled to Italy, which I know you have, AA, and anyone in the audience, mm-hmm. you go to these what were essentially city-state capitals in Italy, you know, whether it could be Alessandria, it could be Mantua, it could be Bologna, wherever. You always have in the center of these places, you know, the piazza, the church, and any associated government buildings. And of course, the campinale is a part of that. And the campinalismo is essentially the culture of these sort of these autonomous, self-governing, self-sufficient city-states dotted across Italy, who had the interest of themselves and their people first and foremost without any other considerations. And I think what Evola kind of evokes to, possibly, I mean, I can't read his mind, but this is just my reckoning of it, is this idea or this ideal of campinalismo being sort of an ideal of this to some degree, of there being a relationship between the urban and the city that is in this symbiosis.
Yeah. All right. So anything else on this quotation, or shall we move on? We've got another line to get through. All right, so this is from Orientations, one of my favorite essays by him, and I think the best introductory essay to his thinking. It's the one I asked Skeptical Waves to upload, which I think, Aaron, you've actually read this one, right? This was your introduction to him.
Yes, this is the only one I've actually read.
And he says, the great illusion of our days is that democracy and liberalism are the antithesis of communism, and have the power to stem the tide of the forces of the low, what is called the progressive movement in the jargon of the labor unions. This illusion is like saying that dusk is the antithesis of night, and that an illness's incipient stage is the antithesis of its acute and endemic stage, or that a diluted poison is the antithesis of the same poison in its pure and concentrated state. Wow, this is a very quick way of getting to a lot of the conclusions that Moldbug got to a few years ago as well. What do we make of this? Because he's very strong on this idea that communism is just kind of the end point of liberalism. Essentially, the Marxists are kind of right about this. It's just that they, you know, he sees it as decline and they see it as progress. He sees it as regression, and they see it as what do we make of this?
I think there's something to it, in a certain sense, suggesting that as soon as you have the sort of classical liberalism, even prior to the sort of managerial stuff that Burnham talks about, where business interests and the state start to operate hand in hand, you basically end up with a sort of merchant racketeering system that gets you to here, depending how quickly it progresses or not.
I think it's interesting that Burnham probably would have agreed with him on liberalism, or at least he would have said liberalism will eventually fall to communism due to its inability to protect itself, but wouldn't probably have agreed on democracy, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think he sees democracy as a yet another symptom of liberalism basically is the force that weakens society enough so that all of these other things like democracy and eventually communism and the rule of the mass man, it's all basically lubricated by, like, liberalism gets the ball rolling. One of the interesting things about Evelar is, and again, this could be because he's Italian, and therefore it was kind of more prescient in his mind. He doesn't start the ball at the French Revolution, as a lot of people do. He actually sees the roots of decline a lot earlier in the Renaissance, and even going back to things that happened before the Renaissance. I think he says at one point that the last kind of true consecrated Holy Roman Emperor was in something like 1452, and that, you know, after that it was just kind of empty and ceremonial, and the spirit, like the true spirit, had gone out of it. So he actually sees the roots of decline a lot earlier. He's pretty down on the Renaissance. He sees the Renaissance as basically the process by which merchants and let's just say foreign interest groups come to dominate banking systems, et cetera, et cetera. Almost the what happens in 1688 in Britain and what happens in 1776 and, you know, the outbreak of democracy everywhere are downstream, basically, of those earlier kind of regressions as he sees them. So
there's a lot of similarities between this and Bond's interpretation of the Juvenal. Maybe that's why you sort of suggest Moldbug was much in the same line. Mm-hmm. Because I think he uses explicitly the example of how the language of the revolution, independence in America in 1776 directly leads to, you know, the attack on state power through the avenue of democracy. He sort of sees it not as the decline, but a necessary process of further universalizing and creating larger groups through the whole process of, what was it, putting the periphery against the secondary and so forth, so on.
Well, and both and De Juvenal in On Power says that both communism and libertarianism are each working towards the same end. They're from different places, which is, you know, the individual being so atomized that they are inevitably reliant on nothing but the state, because all the other support structures have been eaten away either through complete freedom in libertarianism or complete state control in communism. Either way, you're going to create a situation where the individual is so atomized and alone without any support structure, the state inevitably consumes that role.
You made a good point about how Evola believes that we often consider, even in our circles we do it, I mean, I've probably said it myself, that, you know, the origins of this lie in the Enlightenment, lie in the French Revolution and possibly in 1776, etc., and that Evola puts this marker back rather further back. I remember you sort of commenting on a few streams ago that, you know, somewhere, you know, back to like the 1200s where Louis the Fair, you know, gave concessions to the peasantry in France, and that was like the start of a rot with European monarchy. And that sort of, he's sort of alluding to this process where, you know, a number of events have occurred in Europe which have sort of, the cracks of the seam have begun a long, long way in the past ago, and that these sort of trickles have become the torrent, which has sort of ended up with modernity, and that simply democratic liberalism and communism are just, in some ways, they fuel each other, and in other ways, they're just divergences of a similar endpoint, or go down, traverse the same pathway to the same endpoint. And moreover, this for me is also reminds me, and Auron, do correct me if I'm wrong, because I can't remember if it was a land or Spandrel, but this reminds me of the way Charlie described the political trichotomy, how you essentially have monarchy on one corner of that triangle, and then how you have sort of like liberal democracy and communism at other ends, or individualism, whatever it is, and how they're just dualistic expressions of this same rebellion against nature, rebellion against hierarchy, rebellion against order and tradition. And they're almost they share that common thrust about them.
Yeah, Spandrel's big on the political triangles and the
Thanks. I couldn't remember who it was, but yeah, okay, Spandrel. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, no, I think there's one other thing to remember about why he's setting it a bit further back as well, which is that Evalor has a let's just say a complicated relationship with Catholicism, but he was always quite critical of the Catholic Church as it had existed through history. And I think that his basic argument is that by you know, the 1400s, 1500s, the church had already kind of lost its spiritual center, that the spirit in it had already kind of died as a living force. And, you know, it's in that period that you get, I mean, you literally get the farcical scenarios in the Renaissance where, you know, like one of the popes is literally a Medici, and then you get a Borgia who's a pope, and, you know, then his nephew becomes the pope. And I mean, it is a joke, really, when you start to think about it.
And then they both have relations with Lucrezia, the daughter / sister. It's
it's just morbid. So he, I mean, he's saying that, how can I say that it's a little bit complicated, but essentially the Catholic Church lost its esoteric content and its spiritual content, and just became kind of like a kind of empty formalism where, yes, you were maintaining these rituals and so on, but they'd lost a lot of their power. Also, and again, this is a little bit complicated if you don't know the traditionalist stuff, but he saw a lot of the vitality coming from a kind of divine king figure. If you think of like Aragorn from Lord of the Rings, you know, that this sort of character where, yes, there's a deep spiritualism in them, and they are, you know, a celestial body, if you want, but they also wield a sword. So he didn't see any capacity for a priest class to rule in a way that would be able to stop the forces of entropy taking over in the long run. So he saw the priestly class as being fundamentally feminine. And this is something else that is going on in his conception of the medieval era, that once the kings had lost their kind of divine power, if you want to put it that way, and just became like mere military leaders, then there's this more feminine, sly priest class that comes in, which I guess weakens the ruling elites enough to allow the merchants in for the next for the Bronze Age, if that makes any sense. So
and also the medieval period is, you as you rightly state, is the last epoch essentially where the nobility, and certainly in this case monarchs specifically, are donning armor and fighting with their soldiers in a true sort of holy warrior king archetype, which dies after this period.
Yeah. All right. So then we let's go to another one. So this is a particular interest to Evelyn, I'm sure. This is from the third sex, from the Bow in the Club. The Bow and the Club. Democracy is not a mere political and social fact. It is a general climate which, in the long run, is destined to have regressive consequences on the existential level itself. In a particular domain of the sexes, this can promote the kind of inner decay, the kind of weakening of the inner power of sexuation that, as already noted, represents the premise for the emergence and spread of the third sex, and with it, of many truly striking forms of homosexuality in contemporary society. On the other hand, another consequence of all this is the visible trivialization and primitivization of normal sexual relations between young members of the latest generations, on account of reduced tension due to the lower degree of polarity. Even certain strange phenomena, which were apparently very rare in the past, such as sex changes, men taking on female bodies and vice versa, may be understood in the same terms and traced back to the same causes. It is as though in today's general climate, the potentialities of the opposite gender contained within each of us had acquired an exceptional possibility of resurfacing and activating itself on account of the weakening of that central force which even biologically defines one's type to the point of replacing and changing the sex one was born with. Evelyn?
I don't know. I'll be honest. I think that's actually, there is some relatively fair element to that. I think if something along the lines of, like, you know, the average decline in male testosterone since, say, the 1900s or whatever is sort of precisely what he's talking about. I don't know exactly how it would tie that into weird sort of genetic freaks, but I suppose he kind of makes that exception. It's just, I don't know, it's an interesting take on it, and it's a lot more sort of nuanced and subtle than I think people really expect from traditionalist sort of writers. It's kind of why I had a bit of a spaff with some people the other day, but they seemed to, they latched on to the very sort of bourgeois traditionalism that you were talking about, that mm-hmm. would sort of just talk brazenly about how homosexuality is just inherently wrong, blah, 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 it's sin, therefore don't do it. So on and so forth. Whereas, you know, of all that, I think it's slightly before this part in the same chapter, he sort of almost suggests that there are those people to which to ask them to act naturally is to act in this manner, and that mm-hmm. to ask them not to be homosexual would be against their nature, and to him that would actually be the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, because I mean, he's literally saying this is the waters that we swim in, which is something I've been saying recently, and it's like, well, this is like, if you weaken tradition to the point where this is taking place, the actual differences between men and women are starting to reduce, and I do think you can see this all around us. You know, I mean, a few weeks ago we had the Zoomers Akumas whole saga, you know, when we were talking about the importance of normal gender roles. But even people who, you know, identify as men and women who identify as women, I think it's generally the case that men are more feminine now than they would have been in his time, and more feminine then than they would have been in, let's say, 1900. And the same is true of women the other way. Women are getting more masculine. I mean, what do you think, Furious?
Definitely in the context that you're sort of suggesting that the lines are blurring, and I think that is perfectly evident from any sort of objective observational standpoint, that the men of today, even those who might outwardly appeal or outwardly demonstrate sort of like an alpha sort of exoskeleton, if I can use the word, but sort of, you know, are they truly men, you know, in a transcendental or spiritual context, you know? And then you sort of get into the whole what sort of defines men and women in a sort of an esoteric kind of sort of beyond physical matter. I mean, mm-hmm. that becomes a complicated discussion, but that's what I think Evola is alluding to. And then that also being true of women and the sort of political climate that we find ourselves in, these lines are being intentionally blurred, and we see it sort of every day. You know, it's kind of like the, if you want to see like the tabloids from like when it, because I mean, I know in England the races are as big as what they are in Australia, you know, horse racing, whatever. And you get the people, they go out to the cup and you sort of see those photos of you know, the women with their sort of tatty dresses and they're walking barefooted and they're sort of spewing over fences. I mean, it's not ladylike, is it? But here we are. That's the present age that we live in, and that is a consequence of these this convergence and the lines blurring.
Any thoughts, Aaron?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite the called shot on his part. I think it is interesting that he does link it. He's not just making a prediction about the future. He's directly linking it to kind of the spirit of democracy. And I guess in his mind, it's maybe I don't have all the context around the quote, but maybe the removal of kind of hierarchies of differentiated and clear roles that's going to lead us down this path inevitably.
Yeah. I mean, he's as we'll see in a quotation that I'll pull up in a second. All of these things are connected in his. It's not like you can say, all right, I'm a traditionalist, but I'm for democracy. Or I'm a traditionalist and I'm for feminism. You have to see these things as being fundamentally connected, and there's no halfway house. There's no like sipping one bit of poison and thinking that it's not going to kill you. Like any of these paths are going to take you down the same road because they're all downstream of the same thing, which is the revolt against you know, what was normal and natural for thousands of years.
So in his mind, if you know, anyone can rule and anyone can select rulers, and anyone can kind of keep rulers in check, then all, you know, your other more natural barriers will also start to break down because those definitions will fall apart.
Well, it's not even just the principle of sort of universal suffrage. He's talking sort of on a metaphysical level of, if you adopt the mindset of I am my own ruler, we all rule each other equally, I think you try to get to the level how that actually affects you on a level almost sort of subconsciously. I mean, he's almost sort of got like an anti-Freudian thing going on.
Yeah, I mean, the one of the things to understand with Evola, as I will outline in another video that is airing today, which viewers may have already seen, is that for Evola, the spirit always comes before biology. So, and again, remember his context. He's writing at a time when, you know, the Nazis were obsessed with eugenics, right? And in his view, the spirit always comes first, to the extent where a man could embody a female spirit, okay? Or if you want to think about it in racial terms, you could literally become, I don't know, like spiritually black or spiritually Jewish, if that makes any sense, even if you are 100% biologically not that. You know, and this is why he's saying it's so important to maintain a traditional spirit as against all these things, because all of these other things that people point to are not enough of a defense against like pure entropy of modernity. If you just want to rely on, I am a Nordic man, I'm a Nordic German man, let's say, that is not enough of a defense against these forces that we're talking about. Yeah,
it's interesting too, because when Evelyn spoke, the democracy thing kind of just missed me initially. And he's also speaking at a time too, you know, especially he as a veteran of the First World War and having been essentially a first-hand observer of the consequences of World War One, and you sort of see that initial sort of victory over sort of the Arsenal democracy over sort of this hierarchical rusted on European, you know, autocratic rule by monarchs and kings, and that Evola has, and time has proven this to be right, observed and judged democracy to have been this sort of like a shoehorn or a wedge that once people are sold this idea that you are free of, and then you've just got a dash where it's sort of a placeholder for anything that someone wants to be liberated from, whether it's a king, whether it's a class, or it could be, as we're specifically talking about, a gender or a rebellion against nature itself. Like, anyone can place anything in that blank category to be free from. And mm-hmm. once you permit that, you cannot hold, never mind a society, you cannot hold a civilization together, because once this sort of dimorphism occurs that he's explaining here, where sort of like, you know, this convergence of gender, for example, a society can't sustain itself. And really what we've seen from Evola's time to now is sort of that playing out almost to a T.
Yeah, it's remarkable. This logic is also in Carlyle as well, by the way, which is probably where, I mean, we mentioned Moldbug. He got his idea of democracy being a force of entropy from anyone. It would be from Carlyle, I'd imagine. It's the same thing playing out. Shall we move on in the interests of time? So here's a bit from the Metaphysics of War. This is a piece called The Meaning of the Crusades. He says, those who regard the Crusades with indignation as among the most extravagant episodes of the Dark Middle Ages have not even the slightest suspicion that what they call religious fanaticism was the visible sign of the presence and effectiveness of a sensitivity and decisiveness, the absence of which is more characteristic of true barbarism. In fact, the man of the Crusades was able to rise, to fight and to die for a purpose which, in its essence, was supra-political and supra-human, and to serve on the front, defined no longer by what is particularistic, but rather by what is universal. This remains a value, an unshakable point of reference. Naturally, this must not be misunderstood to mean that the transcendent motive may be used as an excuse for the warrior to become indifferent, to forget the duties inherent in his belonging to a race and to a fatherland. This is not at all our point, which concerns rather the essentially deeply disparate meanings according to which actions and sacrifices can be experienced, despite the fact that, from the external point of view, they may be absolutely the same. There is a radical difference between the one who engages in warfare simply as such and the one who simultaneously engages in sacred war and finds it in a higher experience, both desired and desirable for the spirit. And I should mention here that Evola did try to enlist to fight in World War II, and he wanted to fight on the front line, and I can't actually remember the reason, but they wouldn't let him enlist during the war. I can't remember why, but they said he couldn't join the army. So what do we make of this? I don't know if you've got to the bit in Bow and the Club yet, Evelyn, but he's very against the American glorification of violence, like gangsterism or boxing, or he sees those as barbaric, but he's pro like dueling, fencing, and medieval style combat and chivalry and things like that.
He sort of suggests that, and this much in the same way as we're talking before about sort of proliferation for proliferation's sake, that violence for violence's sake totally dilutes its real sort of purpose.
So what he's saying here is that the Crusades, you know, they were fighting for something higher, basically. They were certainly fighting for something beyond, and therefore this is something that must be understood outside of just barbarism. Like, when modern people look back at the Crusades and say, oh, well, isn't that awful? Look at the violence. He's actually saying they're missing how important and spiritual that war was.
Mm. Well, I think it's a very good test of, I think, whether it's quite a simplistic phrase, but whether or not people really get it. I mean, I think if you don't in some way, shape or form think of the Crusades and there isn't some form of at least minimal kind of animating spirit of that was a just sort of conquest, then you're kind of missing... It's not even necessary in the sense that you need to be pro the Crusaders, but you need to at least be able to understand why they did it and what purpose they did it for. And if you aren't capable of that, you're just not cut out, I think, is sort of what he's trying to say in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Any thoughts, Furious?
I could say an awful lot about this because even though the Posse hasn't touched on the Crusades, it is something I actually wrote about at university, and you could imagine it's a contentious issue to write about in modern academia. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in a strange way, it's almost, you know, I think I've echoed this before, but I've sometimes said that, you know, the left are almost always wrong, but sort of a broken clock is right twice a day, and sometimes they inadvertently sort of hit a nugget of truth by accident. And the way that, say, like the modern left will portray the Crusades as being this barbarous sort of Western bellicose act, and it was just sort of from some deep-seated sense of Islamophobia. Now, I don't necessarily agree with that, but what I do see is the left identifying, and from the Western standpoint, we sort of say, no, it's defensive, no, it was Christianity protecting itself. Actually, the left actually see this conflict being more than just a religious struggle. It is actually, in some ways, a struggle between the Occident and the Orient. You know, it is a battle between East and West, and that both sides were sort of motivated by a superhuman zeal. You might say, like, Evola sort of quite fittingly sort of describes this as super political and superhuman motivations that the Crusaders were driven by. And sort of to tack on to what Evelyn said is that these are men who, certainly in the context of the First Crusade, where they more or less marched from Europe, from Italy / France and Germany, through the Balkans, across the Bosphorus, through Anatolia, and then from Anatolia through Syria and Jerusalem, they were in hostile territory where they were subjected to monumental hardships and had to fight off innumerable attacks from enemies, and then eventually achieved their objective by capturing Jerusalem on Christmas Day in 1099. That the kind of person who would have had to have endured the circumstances and then succeeded in their task must have been someone who literally bordered on superhuman. And a lot of people in the modern world do not have the capacity to comprehend that, both in a physical and in a metaphysical context.
Aaron?
Yeah, it's interesting. Today I ran back into C.S. Lewis's essay because Skeptical Waves posted it, but I read it before, like Living in the Atomic Age or something to that effect. And he says, the only people who are going to defend a civilization are those who, or something like, only people who care about something beyond their civilization are likely to be the people who will defend their civilization. And I think here you're looking at people who, like he said, you don't want to forget, like, you're part of a nation, you're part of a fatherland of people, but also there are things greater and beyond that tie you to these people and to something beyond yourself. And so, I think of today we have, you think of the bug men who are trying to kind of glue our civilization together, people like Matthew Iglesias, who they just want to keep kind of the neoliberalism running. And so their ideas are things like, well, just have a billion Americans, just bring in enough people to keep things going. They don't think about why you would keep it going. What would matter? What would be the thing that makes America, America, or, any other nation what it is? And why is it worth saving in the first place? It's simply just defend just keep the thing going because we need to. But I think here he's obviously talking about something that moves beyond those purposes, and that's the only thing that's going to create the kind of people who then will keep you, who will end up keeping your civilization, defended.
Now, when I posted this on Twitter, somebody piped up and said, "Yeah, but by the same logic, you're justifying jihad." Oh no. I should mention that this has been a standard kind of modern critique of Evola, that if you take his views to the ultimate, then there's nothing that the jihadis are doing are wrong. And from his point of view, he would say yes. And I don't want to obviously disavow, but I think that he, like, were he around today, he would probably seen what happened on 9/11, or he would have probably seen the actions of the various jihadis that we've seen in metaphysical and heroic terms, which is something that is probably worth just acknowledging at the very least.
So what you're saying is he'd be writing his essays from the caves of Tora Bora?
I don't know. I mean, Evola probably would have gone and stayed with Bin Laden. I don't know.
Julius, I mean, Al Evola.
although I will say that his kind of mentor and friend, René Guénon, went to live in Egypt, in Cairo, and became a Sufi Muslim. And Evola basically said that's not really an option if you're from the West. And he was like, you can't do that. You cannot really take on, like, Guénon really was so black-pilled. He said, like, the West is beyond saving, so the only option with a man of tradition is to join the East, effectively. Whereas Evola believed that the East had a different, like, animating spirit, and that you had to stay true to the spirit of the West. So there's no, like, I guess in a strange way, there's no, like, going native and becoming a Sufi if you are a true Evolian. Yeah.
Essentially, Evola sort of emphasizes that what Guénon has done was to sort of, you might say, find greener pastures, but that is the duty and is the obligation of a man of the West to dig within himself to find the utmost expression of the Western ideal, and that sits within the Western man. It's just up to him or her, but him, to find it.
Yeah, I'll also say that this piece here, this Meaning of the Crusades, I believe was in a newspaper. There was a newspaper in fascist Italy. I can't remember what it was called now. It's called something like the Daily Fascist or whatever, that he wrote in regularly. So this is one of the most of his books and his essays and things are not for a mass audience, whereas this was. So though, you see where he says, you know, race and fatherland and so on. You'll notice there's a slight difference in tone when Evola writes for the newspaper as opposed to, you know, for a specialist audience. He's a bit more kind of, how can I put it, like, well-behaved for the fascist authorities when he's writing in this way. So he'll occasionally drop in something that would have kept, kept the government happy. I'll also say that after the Second World War, I can't remember exactly, but he talks about the difference between the kind of chivalry and the kind of spiritual element of something like the Crusades, and how, even though in many ways it was a deeply spiritual war, World War II, you know, a battle for the soul of Europe, quite literally, that any heroic element was denied by the doctrine of total war. You know, how can you have heroism when you're literally just leveling cities by bombing them?
Total war is the war of the mass man, and the mass man has no individual identity. It's a war of soldiers, not of warriors.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I think there's also a point, and I think it's Schmitz referencing Clausewitz at some point, and he's sort of talking about how at the point at which war sort of separates itself from actual skill, you know, if you're no longer handling a blade, or even, I think he suggests, you know, one of the last proper forms of trained military men were possibly snipers, or those who operated, you know, what would be the phrase, quite accurate artillery. And it, because that required some ability for you to learn. It's not, as you're saying, it's the, just push a button and blow a town up.
Yeah. All right. So in the interest of time, let's move on. So this is an interesting one. This is from Recognitions. It's an essay called The State and Work. He says, in every sane and normal vision of life, work must be considered a simple means of sustenance in the case of beings who are not qualified to perform an activity of a higher kind, to work as an end in and of itself, and beyond that which is required for one's own sustenance, is an aberration. And precisely the worker ought to understand this. The work ethic, the humanism of work, workers' honour, and all the rest of this blathering are naught but means of mystification. So as better weld the chains that bind the worker to the mechanism of production, which has almost become an autonomous process. If the climate of social, and in that little ellipsis there, he brings up the example of when that American company went to Asia and the entrepreneur doubled the wages, and the all of the workers in this place they were, because they were traditional, halved their hours. They were like, well, we don't need to work anymore because you've doubled our wages, which is a very different way of looking at the problem. He says, if the climate of social progress, of overreaching one's proper condition at all, of artificially multiplying one's needs, did not make such an attitude appear depreciable, precisely the prevalence of this attitude in normalized inferior social strata, and also in superior ones, would be one of the most efficacious means to stop the gigantic unleashing, that is, the economy, the productive paroxysm, which is becoming the destiny of civilized humanity. Returning a moment to classical antiquity, beyond otium, in the sense here clarified, another term, was held as antithesis to labor. Opus, a work. Properly speaking, one applied labor to the slave alone, while the free man accomplished works, whence the Latin term opifex, which evidently in this connection cannot be translated by worker in the modern sense. Now, Spengler has indicated a most significant mutation when he observed that while modern man tends to labor, even when he produces a work, that is, when he creates, acts, accomplishes, traditional man gave the higher character of work even to that which he could, in a certain sense, be a job. Moreover, this qualitative character was maintained up until yesterday in the realm of traditional artisanship. That the paradox is that in the exhalation of work and the tendency to reduce the state to a mere worker state, work is ever more discredited. It has lost and has had to lose in exceedingly wide sectors its personal and qualitative character as a work, so far as to sink ever lower along the scale of activities worthy of a free man, which are exercised not for the necessity or merely for the prospect of gain. I can't help but think of like the McDonald's minion here, or the person working on the till in the supermarket. But Aaron, any thoughts on this?
Well, I think it's interesting that, you know, he talks about, you know, work for work's sake not being the best thing, but it almost immediately then launches into what work actually is. I think a lot of people would agree with the second part, you know, where what work has become drudgery. It's been, you know, the skill is out of it, the passion, the things of craftsmanship that make it edifying, you know, is out, and simply the, you know, drudging through and filling a role in a machine simply to make sure that, you know, you have the bread and the roof is something that is less edifying to people. I don't know. It's a very, I do think there's a lot of value to work. And so the first part, you know, but I think he has a great point in the second half where he's talking about, you know, what work has become.
One of the things that struck me when I pulled this one out is how, in a way, America really does have a very strong pro-work attitude. I mean, you can even see it to this day. There's a difference between the American attitude to work and even the British attitude to work, or the European attitude to work. Where in America, like you guys get like barely any holidays. It's just, how can I put it? It's like deeply ingrained in the culture, this idea that work is good.
Ozzy's earlier point where he discusses, you know, the fascination with bigger being an importation from sub-Saharan Africa, essentially, it would make sense that America would then experience that more than, say, for example, in Europe. I do find the first part of the statement quite interesting. There's almost some like economics lessons in there where he's discussing the worker in the same way that Mises would talk kind of philosophically about Homo economicus and his sort of notion of, you know, the you sacrificing yourself for the economy is the productive part of you playing a position in civilization is sort of how Mises also talks about this sort of as the Volkswirtschaft or whatever, which was the sort of German notion of the economy becoming its own sort of animating thing that has a life of its own through this sort of seeing, you know, the worker as almost the sort of metaphysical equivalent of the Homo economicus that Mises sees.
It's almost like it's the economic component of the Volksgemeinschaft, to use another German word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you see, I can't help but see in this a kind of a Latin critique of Anglo Calvinist values here. I mean, this is one of the sharpest disagreements between Evola and someone like Carlyle, for example. I mean, Carlyle thought work was so good that you should, you know, I mean, he literally says at one point, if somebody won't work, you should beat them until they do, because work is good in and of itself. You know, in his very spicy essay, you know, where he kind of defends slavery. Whereas, I don't know, maybe it's the kind of Mediterranean mindset or whatever, but he just doesn't see that. And I still think that endures to an extent between like the Catholic world and the kind of Anglo-Saxon world, this attitude to work.
The land of punctuality versus the land of the siesta, sort of. One thing which stood out for me is that I do appreciate that he emphasizes the distinction between labor and a work. And when I saw the way he does emphasize a work, your videos about John Smith, the late medieval blacksmith, jumped out at me. Mm-hmm. And I think this is where perhaps there's less antagonism between this Mediterranean North European culture, in that if you actually dig down into what it means, a work, it could mean anything from Michelangelo and Da Vinci, and, you know, the Statue of David and the roof of the Sistine Chapel being a work, or a series of works that culminate together in a work. Or indeed, you know, a humble tailor who makes a nice series of suits, and they're an expression of his personal ability, you know, in the same way that, say, John Smith would fashion a good sword or a good pickfork or something, you know.
I think it's worth remembering, though, that whether you're a blacksmith or a carpenter or a tailor, you would have belonged to a guild.
Correct.
And as part of that, you would have had a master, and you would have been apprenticed to a master. And then to become a master yourself, you had to create a masterwork or a masterpiece.
Exactly. Right? Exactly.
So the master tailor, okay, you know, he may have been a humble guy, and, you know, but he would have had a masterpiece. Otherwise, he wouldn't have achieved that rank and been able to run his own shop. So, you know,
it's like if anyone who's been to Firenze or Florence in Tuscany, and they've been to the Duomo or the cathedral there, the name sadly escapes me, I just have forgotten it, but the man who created the doors for the church, when he started the work on it, he was just either an apprentice or had finished his apprenticeship under a previous master, and it took him 37 years of continuous craftsmanship to make the doors to one cathedral. But those doors are his opus magnus, in a sense, his great work, and that's what made him a master.
Yeah, and this is, you see, and this is another thing about the fundamental orientation of Evola against the mass man and against modernity. You know, the modern mindset would be like, okay, yeah, but he took 37 years to make a door. That's a very poor return. You know, that's very inefficient use of time. It's, you know, it's not really maximizing the inputs versus the outputs. But that's a purely quantitative way of seeing the problem, and it treats quantity as the thing, as the barometer, whereas the idea of the work or the masterpiece, you're operating on a purely qualitative sense, where your aim is not just mass production all the time. And again, I mentioned Carlyle. He does talk about this, where when you get industrialization happening, he calls it, this is the cheap and nasty. Now you've got 30,000 unwashed kind of needle women as opposed to the master tailor, and you just pay the cheapest one who'll make you between them they can bang out way more skirts than you would have had back in the day, but maybe the master tailor would have made you a nicer skirt,
and the way Evol's articulating this, it's almost as if the argument almost heads down the road of that a great work almost transcends time, and that it must it can't be shackled by time. And just before we move on to the slide, because I actually want to echo this, because it's actually a convergence between Evola's thinking and the German mentality, is that there's a really good saying from German, and I hope my German is spot on with this, and I believe it is, ein gute Arbeit wird ist eine gute Arbeit bleibt, which means that a good work remains a good work. And I think that's sort of what Evola is alluding to as well, is that, okay, it's nice having sort of 30,000 kettles that cost, $4.50, but, a master did make that, whereas John Smith might make, three cauldrons in his lifetime or something, or, I'm just picking something out. But each of those things, he put his mind into it, his spirit into it, his craftsmanship is revealed in those cauldrons or those pots or whatever, and they are unique. No other iron worker will make pots like that. They are individually his, and they are his work, no matter how humble they are.
I think it's similar to the phrase, I think he borrows it from Spengler, it's the start of the war in the club, or say the bow in the club, where he suggests, that traditional civilization consumes time, modern civilization consumes space. A work, in the way that you're talking about it, is timeless, and that it's an infinite resource to it. It will always exist through time because some intrinsic other meaning is imbued in it, whereas any form of mass consumer good to be remembered or revered in any way, shape or form must be produced in such a scale that it just becomes an object.
All right, so in the interest of time, let's move on. So this is from Men Among the Ruins. The essence of liberalism is individualism. The basis of its error is to mistake the notion of the person with that of the individual, and to claim for the latter unconditionally and according to egalitarian premises some values that should be rather attributed solely to the former, and then only conditionally. Because of this transposition, these values are transformed into errors or into something absurd and harmful. Let us begin with the egalitarian premise. It is necessary to state from the outset that the immortal principle of equality is sheer nonsense. There is no need to comment on the inequality of human beings from a naturalistic point of view, and yet the champions of egalitarianism make equality a matter of principle, claiming that while human beings are not equal de facto, they are so de jure. They are unequal and yet should not be. Inequality is unfair. The merit and superiority of the liberal idea allegedly consists of not taking it into account, overcoming it, and acknowledging the same dignity in every man. Democracy, too, shares the belief in the fundamental equality of anything that happens to be human. I believe that these are mere empty words. This is not a noble ideal, but something that, if taken absolutely, represents a logical absurdity. Wherever this view becomes an established trend, it may usher in only regression and decadence. Aaron?
Yeah, I think this is something that almost all thinkers that we would describe maybe as reactionary or traditional point to, right? You can hear echoes of this in everyone from, Moldbug all the way back to Carlyle and all these different authors who are rejecting, kind of enlightenment liberalism. And I think this is just a fundamental attack on, you know, kind of the current idea of liberalism that rules our day and is a core factor in many of the mistakes. Like you said, just leads to terrible conclusions and structuring society in a way that's just kind of doom it to failure.
And I should mention that one of the people that Evola seems to draw on quite a lot is De Maistre. Mm-hmm. Even in this passage, a little bit later on, he mentions De Maistre. So there's definitely a canon of reactionary thinkers that he draws from as well. Spengler's another one who he seems to quote quite a lot. But Evelyn, any thoughts on this one?
Yeah, it's kind of quite far up the tree to the sort of destroying of liberalism within oneself. He's sort of suggesting in long form that if you could admit that some people are not capable of owning themselves, then you're actually speaking a lot more truth than anyone who's saying that we are all equally in, you know, operation and ownership of ourselves in a way that guarantees us rights.
Yeah, and no, there is something interesting about Evola when it comes to this question, though, because when he's defending notions like nobility and aristocracy, remember he puts spirit above blood, right? So he does not defend let's say there's a great emperor and he has a son and he's a shithead, right? And he ends up getting overthrown. In Evola's view, he would be like, yeah, obviously, because that son didn't have a noble spirit and the guy who's taken over maybe does, you know. So I don't know if you think of like King Darius, which I've mentioned a few times recently, like obviously he was imbued with a more noble spirit than the sons of
Cambyses.
And you see that time and again in history, don't you, where a particular royal family or monarchy gets weak at a certain time, and then somebody else rises, even though they don't come from a noble background. You know, we mentioned John, or like the Jon Snow character in Game of Thrones, although I think he does have noble blood, doesn't he? It's revealed, but still. So there is a kind of like, I don't know if I'd call it an egalitarianism, but he is more or less saying that this spirit can come from anywhere. Carlyle also does when he's talking about his various heroes. You know, think of someone like, I don't know, Cromwell, say, you know, like it can cut, or Muhammad or whoever it happens to be. It can come from somewhere, but it's because these people are tapping into, you know, the absolute or something like this. Well,
I was going to say I think the Stuarts coming into power in Scotland would also be an example of that, where it's just a sort of a random gaggle of a few people stolen from Norway who weren't really significant in any way, shape or form, but were willing to stand behind some of the last sort of components of the Reformation. I think I've got that right.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not trying to suggest that this is an egalitarianism in Evola's thinking, but he is, when we say he's an aristocrat, I think people think, well, yeah, he's just defending an old discredited order. But he's not just like saying, well, you know, I don't know if you guys watched AM's stream on the Queen. You were on it, weren't you, Furious? Were you on there?
Yeah, I was. My turnaround has been quite quick, so right back into it.
But like you guys were saying there. I mean, it's like, yeah. Well, you defend the ideal and the notion of the celestial body in the monarch, right? That does not mean that you have to defend like literally like Prince William or something.
Well, for instance, there was and I don't want to beat up on the person, and I'll keep them anonymous here. There was a gentleman in the chat who actually had served in the armed forces in Britain and had mm-hmm. basically contested. He said, you know, I've taken an oath to serve my queen and my country. How can I betray this queen? And we said, listen, we're not here to have a go at you or give people like you a dressing down. This is not what this exercise is. Even we're not even so much here to drag down Lizzie specifically, but this has been a culture that has been alive within the Windsors for a number of years of a relatively liberal bent, which has, you know, sort of infected the family. And that as a royal, as a monarch, to fit, you know, by definition, when you take the oath and you have the crown placed upon your head, with that comes duties and obligations and responsibilities which nobody else in the land has. And if you cannot live up to those and you cannot fulfill those, do not be the monarch. Do not accept the crown. And basically what the Windsors have done is they've wanted their cake and they've eaten it as well. And there are many examples in history. And, I mean, you know, if you go through the work of, well, I mean, Apostolic himself, because it's his channel, but the work that, say, like myself and Columba have done with him, where we've covered, you know, a number of different dynasties from a number of different nations, you know, whether it's been a Capetian France or Charlemagne or the Byzantine Empire, doesn't matter. You know, even ancient Gaul as an example, like Vercingetorix, you know, if you want to pull up an ancient example of this, where men, great men in history, have taken up the yoke of monumental duties and responsibilities, have led from the front, either figuratively or literally, and have fulfilled their duties to the utmost of their sort of physical and spiritual strength. And I think what Paula is alluding to here is that aristocracy, the way that this is misunderstood by people who might be either liberal in worldview or, you know, more egalitarian in their outlook, is that the aristocracy were just outdated and they'll cross it on. And you know, there might be aspects of that critique which have truth to it. But what Avola is trying to say is that aristocracy is not just your blood pedigree. Nobility and aristocracy is as much a spiritual and a metaphysical state of being as it is bloodlines. The two exist hand in hand.
Yes. All right, so let's move on in the interest of time then. So this is Feminism and the Twilight of Civilization from the Metaphysics of Power, one of the latest books of Evola's to be translated. Came out with Arcdos. He says, the leveling and depersonalizing plague which has brought our modern civilization, brought low our modern civilization, has aspects which are so complex and tentacular that not everyone is able to recognize it behind its various masks, so as to oppose each of its forms with a decisive revolt and a conscious reaction. And thus it is a fact that the by now irreparable compromise of those differences in caste, in nature, and in internal dignity which form the principle of every healthy traditional organization leads to no good end. In aiming to bring every value under the law of quantity and of the anonymity of the mere social collective, this contaminating ideology now desires that, after the leveling wrought between man and man, we proceed now to that between gender and gender. It sees in this a conquest, a sign of progress. From the very same anti-hierarchical and anti-qualitative origin of many forms of modern degenerescence, we now see feminism emerging as if in a retching action. It is taking shape in two countries which have become almost like two jaws of a singular pair of closing vice grips, from the east and from the west, around ancient Europe, Soviet Russia, and America. For the Bolshevik, equality of woman and man in all aspects of social life find its perfect reflection in the emancipation which has already been carried out for some time now on the other side of the ocean. So again, here we see Evola seeing kind of the USSR and America as two sides of the same coin. Evelyn, any thoughts?
Well, it's just that's, I think, is a point that's made. There's maybe one of the sort of, you were talking about the kind of the points of agreement between a lot of the reactionary thinkers. I think especially a lot of the modern ones who were around, especially post World War II, so not so much Burnham, but especially Francis, mm-hmm. all have a similar perspective on there being almost no distinguishable differences between liberalism, communism, even fascism to some extent. They all had to do these strange appeals to groups like women or the worker or whoever it needed to be at that time for whatever centralization was required.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Aaron?
Yeah, again, this reminds me of the de juvenile and reference, and, you know, him pointing to both ends of the spectrum needing to, in order to centralize, needing to create more individualism. And again, by collapsing those traditional spheres, whatever the kind of justification for it is, by collapsing traditional roles and traditional spheres, you know, for family, then the obligations to the family and the power of the family and the necessity of the state or rulers to respect those boundaries falls. And then therefore you can place the same demands on anyone and not feel that, you know, that it's that you're violating or competing with something natural because you've broken down kind of those barriers. And that then allows, you know, for the increased centralization.
Furious.
I guess this sort of almost tangents onto what we're discussing a couple of slides ago, where I sort of mentioned Spandrel's political trichotomy. Essentially, what Evola is alluding to here is the way in which these emancipating sort of feminist ideals that sort of abound in this egalitarian, anti-hierarchical, anti-qualitative origin, to use his words, they have manifested in this sort of Marxist Bolshevist sort of class rebellion style in the Bolshevik East in the USSR. And then meanwhile, in this sort of liberal capitalist American West, that it has its own expression and they look different and they appear different. And they have different, you might say, motivations to them or different sort of ideological propulsion systems, if I can use that turn of phrase, but they are essentially just the same monster with a different mask. And what he's sort of alluding to here is that these two sort of forces, like, you know, to use his accurate terminology, two jaws or the singular pair of closing vice grips, you know, closing around the last standing remnants of European civilization that upholds order, that upholds these distinctions and actually sees the world for what it is. Because, you know, we think of the previous slide there where he sort of took a swipe at anti-egalitarianism and the fact that it's a sort of like an invention of the mind to dismiss hierarchy, to dismiss differentiation between individuals or communities or whatever, that this is another aspect of that, and that it's and that it had manifested itself in two ways, and he sort of accurately identified that.
All right, so let's carry on. So this is a very interesting quotation from Ride the Tiger. He says, in this context, there is another more recent phenomenon that is heavy with significance, that of the so-called global protest movement. It took its rise in part from the order of ideas already mentioned. In the wake of theories such as Marcuse's, it came to the conclusion that there is a basic similarity in terms of technological consumer society between the system of advanced communist countries and that of the capitalist world, because in the former, the original impulse of the proletarian revolution is much diminished. This impulse has now been realized inasmuch as the working class has entered the consumer system, being assured of a lifestyle that is no longer proletarian but bourgeois, the very thing whose absence was the incentive for revolution. But alongside this convergence, there has become visible the conditioning power of one and the same system, manifesting as the tendency to destroy all the higher values of life and personality at the level more or less corresponding to the last man foreseen by Nietzsche. The individual in contemporary consumer society reckons that it would be too expensive, indeed absurd, to do without the comfort and well-being that this evolved society offers him, merely for the sake of an abstract freedom. Thus he accepts with a good grace all the leveling conditionings of the system. This realization has caused a bypassing of revolutionary Marxism, now deprived of its original motive, force, in favor of a global protest against the system. This movement, however, also lacks any higher principle. It is irrational, archaic, anarchic, and instinctive in character. For want of anything else, it calls on the abject minorities of outsiders, on the excluded and rejected, sometimes even on the third world, in which case Marxist fantasies reappear, and on the blacks, as being the only revolutionary potential. But it stands under the sign of nothingness. It is a hysterical revolution of the void and the underground, of maddened wasps trapped in a glass jar, who throw themselves frenetically against the walls. In all of this, it confirms in another way the general nihilistic character of the epoch, and indeed on a much larger scale, for the current protest is no longer that of the individuals and small groups mentioned earlier, whose intellectual level was indubitably higher. For me, this is one of my very favourite passages by Evola anywhere, because it's so prescient to what we've seen in the past few years. You know, just think of those Extinction Rebellion protesters you see in London, or any of the kind of luxury protesting that we see these days. Furious, what do you reckon?
I don't really know what to add to this, to be honest. Maybe pass on the baton. I might just have a bit more of a think on it.
Aaron?
This reminds me, and obviously this would have predated the work I'm going to reference by a good bit, but this reminds me of Spandrel's Bio-Leninism, right? It's the Marxism doesn't take root in many of the Western countries because life is simply too good, or too the economic frustration and conflict, the class conflict simply doesn't exist in the way that is necessary. And so the way to generate this is, rather than trying to make it, you know, the Marxist revolution, is instead to use invert the hierarchy through groups that have been placed outside due to biological or other differences. And so in many ways, you know, they're talking about different or similar lines there. And then it's very interesting that he talks about then how it globalizes, because obviously we can see that strategy that largely began in America takes on very similar, basically just gets exported. Like, even the names of groups that have nothing to do with the countries in which they protest and the struggles that they're protesting against don't really have grounding in those countries. Still, they metastasize over to them, and the same language down to the same exact slogans, even if they're completely plucked from their cultural context, still echo across all these different nations.
The absolute insanity of the bloody BLM protest in Europe last year, for example.
Right. You can see the symbols of the American cathedral just splashed over into all these places where they don't belong, but are still making headway.
Evelyn, any thoughts?
Yeah, as I said, I think there's almost a sort of slight comment on the kind of people you might refer to as Tory boys within here as well, where, you know, he suggests that, you know, thus he accepts with a good grace all the levelling conditions of the system, because, you know, it's not just the Marxists who want to hang on to progress are just as bad as the Conservatives that want to hang on to progress. You know, they are ultimately part of the same sort of global protest. They're just shouting for different reasons and still have just as little purpose and just as little sort of drive to actually achieve anything.
Yeah, we're going to have to move on in the interest of time, but I love that image of the maddened wasps trapped in a glass jar. And if you read on in Ride the Tiger, he talks about, you know, like hippies and punks and all of these kind of youth rebellions that the system generates.
So, yeah,
because that energy has to go somewhere, but it's all just kind of...
I think that applies to the modern day right more than it even does, you know, leftist groups. Even though, you know, leftist groups in the 1960s were still very much astroturfed, you know, it wasn't quite the same maddening because they weren't doing it for themselves, they were being paid to do it. So they're, you know, fair enough, they're still wasps sitting in a glass, but they're not actually motivated to do it because they think it's going to change the world. A lot of them are just paid to do it.
Yeah.
What's interesting here, I will be brief, because I don't have an awful lot to add, but this line here where he states, this impulse is being realized in so much as the working class has entered the consumer system, blah, blah, blah. And just above that, he talks about the original impulse of the proletarian revolution is much diminished, and the working class entered the consumer system. Essentially, that there was always that observation by Marxists that they thought the revolution would occur in England, but it didn't. But in fact, it occurred in Russia, which had a much lower literacy rating, and also was much less educated populace abroad, and suffered quite bad privations of the First World War. And they were successful in Russia, but yet the idea that they could sell this to America, where the what's the phraseology that every American businessman sort of sees themselves as a broke millionaire or something to that effect? Mm-hmm. One of you might correct me. That rather than trying to sell authentic revolution to them in the sort of violent upheaval, which was the Russian Revolution, they could merely achieve, if not identical, but very, very similar ends simply by convincing the working class to become bourgeois, bringing them into the marketplace and using the market and the, and you might say the apparatuses of a usurped government or the mechanisms of the, you know, regime, as we would call it, to get to the similar endpoint via liberalism.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so let's have a look. This is also from Orientations, which we've already quoted from once, but I find it sums up so much of his thinking very well. And it's going to tie up a lot of things that we've been talking about. So he says, what is in our possession is the courage of radicalism, the no spoken to the political decadence in all its forms, both of the left and the supposed right. We must be especially aware of this, that there is no negotiation, there is no negotiating with subversion, and that concessions made today mean condemning ourselves to being completely overwhelmed tomorrow. We therefore insist on intransigence of the idea and a readiness to advance with pure forces when the right moment arrives. In the face of our radicalism, in particular, the antithesis between Red East and Democratic West appears irrelevant. The forms of standardization, conformism, democratic leveling, frantic overproduction, the more or less arrogant and explicit cult of the expert, the brain trust, and the petty materialism of Americanism can only clear the road for the final phase, which is represented in the same direction by the communist ideal of the mass man. The distinctive trait of Americanism is that the attack on quality and personality is not accomplished by means of the brutal coercion of a Marxist dictatorship and the care of the state, but takes place almost spontaneously by means of a civilization that does not recognize ideals higher than wealth, consumption, profit, and unchecked economic growth, an exaggeration and reductio ad absurdum of what Europe herself has chosen. This is what the same motives have created there, or are in the process of creating. On both sides, we see the same primitivism, mechanical reductionism, and brutality. In a certain sense, Americanism is for us more dangerous than communism because it is essentially a kind of Trojan horse. When the attack against those values of the European tradition, which yet survive, are found in the direct and naked form that belongs to the Bolshevik ideology and Stalinism, it still provokes some reactions and certain lines of resistance, even if weak ones, can be maintained. Things are different when the same evil acts in a subtler manner and the transformations take place insensibly on the level of custom and a general worldview, as is the case with Americanism. By thoughtlessly submitting to the influence of Americanism under the flag of democracy, Europe is already predisposed to the ultimate abdication, and this could come about without the need for a military catastrophe, but more or less the same point could be reached in a progressive fashion after a final social crisis. Again, there is no stopping halfway down the slope. Americanism, willy-nilly, is working for its ostensible enemy, collectivism. So, I mean, these days we just say he's talking about boiling the frog slowly, right, Aaron? Yeah, it's a more insidious enemy, really.
No, absolutely. And this is still, you can see this even today, this is still such a major barrier for American conservatism and just conservatism worldwide is your, or, you know, kind of what we think of conservatism. is just this mentality of, you know, it's, you know, especially with America, you know, you didn't have the same level of classes, you didn't have those same inheritance from Europe, and so wealth generation became the thing that created status, and because that tends to again just break down all those traditional barriers and all those. There's no sense of obligation. You know, it's simply I'm here because I earned it. And there's no sense of, you know, I owe something to other people. I have duties to people because of my status, because that seems to justify every action. It's just this slow march towards inevitably, unfortunately, ending up in the same place. You don't have people in gulags. You don't have, you know, a Politburo sending commissars, you know, to come round people up. You just make sure people can't get jobs. You just make it harder for them to have Thanksgiving. You make it so where maybe if there's a child custody battle, the spouse who agrees with the state wins. And these things just slowly over time, like you said, boil the frog. They just guide everyone still to the same conclusion, almost more insidiously, because they never generate the level of kickback that like more direct tyranny would. And allows them to go much further in the end, even though it has to go slower.
Furious?
Yeah, sort of what Auron has been alluding to is kind of like a dose of poison with a dose of the anesthetic at the same time. It sort of numbs you whilst it kills you. Just on the, I love the end of that opening paragraph. You know, we therefore insist on intransigence of the idea. And the readiness to advance with pure forces when the right moment arrives. It alludes to actually an Italian sort of phraseology that Italians will use for someone who's exceedingly stubborn. They'll call them un asino intransigente, basically an intransigent donkey, you know, or an intransigent ass, you know, or mule. They just will not move from a standpoint. And sort of what more or less what sort of Evola is alluding to here is, and it's very apparent in a lot of his works, and he's this sort of a stance, is this perennial traditionalist, is that once you open, whether in yourself as an individual or you as a community or your nation and your polity, slightly open the door ajar for any of this movement in this direction, what is initially a couple of drops becomes a torrent, and it becomes it is very quickly unstoppable. And it is proven that in a revolutionary context in, say, Russia or Cuba, where there is actually a violent upheaval, sort of which he alludes to here, because he sort of ends that without the need of military catastrophe, those military catastrophes manifested as the Chinese Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the Cuban Revolution, right? But then where, and like I said in the previous frame that we covered, the previous quote where I sort of said that sort of the endpoints of the liberalism and the communist are sort of, if they're not the same, they're very, very close together. They sort of almost converge at their endpoint. You know, how this has been sold in the West via democracy, via egalitarianism, via liberalism, It's this poison with the anesthetic. It's the numbing with the dying at the same time. And you know, I think we can all say that in our lifetimes we have seen this firsthand play out. And like Auron said, that what has been the what we would call possibly the fake opposite, the false opposition, or the, you know, the sort of the weak right, the wets, whatever, the Tory boys, have actually played into this and have not been, not only have failed to be an obstruction to the movement, but have facilitated it further by buying into the majority of its lies in the first place.
Evelyn?
I don't know, I like how this sort of almost reads like something Bin Laden would have produced. You know, if you swapped some of the bits where he's talking about European values and culture with, you know, Islamic values and culture, the way he approaches America as there's just this sort of bastion of pure evil, and there can be no tolerance for it whatsoever. It's a view I find very appealing. I mean, I think it's part of the reason why I find other thinkers like Lenin quite attractive, because they all have this sort of view where the American Empire, on a, you know, on an almost metaphysical level, is just in our minds at all times. We are not allowed to escape it.
Yeah, I should say as well that this also goes to my long-standing talking point that Tony Blair is the more dangerous face of the left, is the stronger face than the Jeremy Corbyn. You know, you actually want the left to be the squad, right? you don't want the left to be, you know, like John McCain or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's much more insidious when it's the Fresh Prince version of the left rather than the authoritarian left. So I actually think that it's better when the left are authoritarian, because at least you can see them, the mask is off. Whereas,
just very quickly, I might just say the squad are the redcoats, whereas Tony Blair's wearing camouflage, you know, hiding behind a bush and you can't see him, sort of thing, you know.
Yeah, exactly. All right, sorry, so let's
go, Evelyn. I interrupted you.
No, I was going to say part of this reason is almost possibly why, as I have said and others have said, you know, the hardcore anti-American tankies that are of a almost kind of a romanticist kind of orient are actually much closer to what we want and possibly to what Evola wants than a lot of the political spectrum. You know, and the way that you were discussing, a lot of what flanks us on the right will totally allow for all of what he's suggesting here. And because of that, they are almost essentially useless to us.
Yeah. Don't forget, though, that the tanky is also evil because they're materialist. Yeah.
That's why you have a purge after the revolution.
And also, Evelyn, they're not only useless to us, they're in fact dead weight as well. Like, they actually numb our ideas, they numb our ability to function and to work towards a better end. They actually inhibit us, you know, they weigh us down in many ways.
Well, see, this absolutely is why I think there's such a big focus on certain parts of the right at the moment about fixing democracy. I think they can see us, and that they have seen, you know, us going into the realms of Evola and Hopper and a facade of other sort of mix of all sorts of other people who are very heavily against democracy. I think they are actually trying to sort of pass us off on that, because ultimately they are infected with Americanism, as Evola tries to suggest.
See, there's no way of coming back at this. Don't forget, Evola doesn't want dialogue. You know, his stance is no dialogue with modernity, right? But if somebody was trying to come back on this, they'd have no choice but to defend Americanism, right? Which is kind of interesting. Anyway, in the interest of time, we must move on. We must move on. This is the last one from The Yoga of Power. Interesting book. He wrote it in 1914. In fact, he kind of wrote it in 1927, but then he went back and rewrote it. He says, "The analysis of the last age, the Dark Age, or Kali Yuga, brings to light two essential features. The first is that mankind living in this age is strictly connected to the body and cannot prescind from it. Therefore, the only way open is not that of pure detachment, as in early Buddhism and in the many varieties of yoga, but rather that of knowledge, awakening, and mastery over secret energies trapped in the body. The second characteristic is that of the dissolution typical of this age. During the Kali Yuga, the bull of Dharma stands only on one foot. It lost the other three during the previous three ages. This means that the traditional law, Dharma, is wavering, is reduced to a shadow of its former self, and seems to be almost succumbing. During Kali Yuga, however, the goddess Kali, who was asleep in the previous ages, is now fully awake. Let us say that this symbolism implies that during the last age, elementary, infernal, and abyssal forces are untrammeled. The immediate task consists in facing and absorbing these forces, in taking the risk of riding the tiger, to use a Chinese expression that may best describe this situation, or to transform the poison into medicine, according to a tantric expression." Now, there's a lot of language from Hinduism and yoga and so on here, but what I thought was interesting about this was, I think, has occurred to a lot of people recently. You know, Endeavor made that video, and what we've seen during the pandemic, that the left and the forces of progressivism are becoming increasingly demonic, right? That there is this infernal, almost abyssal quality to what we're facing now, and its evil is becoming more apparent to us. And I just find it interesting that these ancient texts kind of predict this in a way through this idea of the Kali Yuga. Any thoughts from anyone?
Well, I think it's Evola's trying to focus very heavily on making the reader understand things like Americanism and progressivism as the physical manifestation of something like, you know, the goddess of destruction, you know, that a force that we actually can't really fully comprehend other than we must be against it.
Yeah. Any thoughts, Aaron?
I think one thing that's interesting that I'm reading this, I'm kind of thinking about is, you know, in a lot of ways, the left was able, or progressives, whatever you want to call it, was able to get a lot of people to agree to things that were clearly bad and evil by despiritualizing them, by removing, by saying, you know, spirituality is ridiculous, you know, looking at anything beyond the material is ridiculous, and because it's ridiculous, there's nothing wrong with embracing these things. It was you were able to make that transition because you took away the spiritual aspect, you took away their significance. But now it's very clear that they're attempting in some ways to re-spiritualize it. Now that you can almost see them returning and in some ways like worshiping these things, I think it starts to bring it into starker contrast because you start to see, again, like almost directly that now that the things are being re-spiritualized and now you see what they're worshiping, it becomes almost easier to see like, oh no, these things are directly evil, not just different choices people were making because they had lost their spiritual significance.
Any final thoughts, Furious?
There's an element to this quote that sort of has come to mind that we have, or well, certainly we've all to varying degrees noticed that the left carry with them, the modern left, and be it the sort of tanky commie left or the sort of liberal libertine sort of modern democratic left, the issue is that what they have new and fandangle has never been tried before and is innovative and progressive, et cetera, et cetera. But what these ancient texts actually show is that whilst it might, these sort of ideas and these, as you say, these abyssal forces, these sort of demonic forces might sort of have a more, you know, via a cult of modernity and a cult of modern progressivism might have this sort of veneer, this new fandangled veneer that expresses itself in a very modern way, you know, be it the, oh, what's that show on Netflix with the 14-year-old girls? I can't remember what it was called, that controversy.
Cuties.
Yeah, like cuties and all that. And, you know, television adverts of, you know, the modern family and that sort of stuff. Like, it comes at us in a new way. But it's almost as if these ancient writers always knew and were able to detect these flaws that existed in humanity and of people who sort of will fall to the wayside of these evil and demonic principles. And that the modern left sort of see themselves above this, but rather than being above this, they're actually the embodiment of it. And that, you know, rather than just sort of being something that we are confronted in the modern day, these forces do exist in humanity and have been an enemy of civilization for so long as humanity has had civilization in one way or another. You know, decadence might express itself in different ways and might be, it might have different features from one age to another or in one geography or civilization from another. But they have a lot of commonality, and this is not the first time we've ended up here. I mean, there's a reason why, for example, like even in a biblical context, you know, they talk about Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, these themes repeat through history. Anyone who studied history and understands, or at least in my case, has a basic understanding of philosophy, because I'm not a philosopher, but these patterns and have occurred before, and humanity does have these failings, and, you know, history doesn't always rhyme, but it very often repeats itself, and you would have to be ignorant to not realize that.
Well, yeah, just to say very quickly, you know, some of these other works, these more like overtly spiritual works, like the Yoga of Power, one of the things I was struck by reading it though is the language. I mean, the way he talks about the Kali Yuga in this book, you can almost picture, like, I don't know if you remember like a horror film where all these hands are coming from below, right? And they're trying to like drag you down, and they're trying to, and you know, the purpose is not to say, like he's saying, like basically there's nothing you can do. You can't save all those people. You cannot stop the entropy dead. All you can really do in this sort of scenario is to master yourself so that you do not succumb, so that you don't get dragged down into hell with them, type thing.
Essentially, if you're in the crevasse, it's already too late for 99% of people, essentially, and saving yourself is possible if you haven't fallen in yet.
Yeah.
Well, that's the, I think it's the point he makes after discussing some of the stuff in the third sex, where he says, you know, it should be just seen as a mark of the times, and to bother trying to remedy it all is just to try and grasp the sand within your hands or something like that, I think is what he says. But I think it's kind of, especially in this quote here, we'd see kind of what I think what you've framed as what it means to be right wing, which to sort of uncover sort of truths that have just sort of been lost. And at a certain sense, I think Evola is the person that does that almost the most. You know, he goes to these sort of deepest, darkest corners of history to try and really discern what constitutes human nature.
Yeah, it is fascinating. Well, thank you very much, all. I think that was the last quote. Hopefully this discussion has been good. There's much more still to come on Evola Day. And other people will be dropping videos as well. So just look out on your feeds for all your favorite channels. I know at least two other people are going to make videos. So, hopefully, this has been a good introduction to some of Evola's thinking through 10 quotations. Evelyn, Auron, and Furious, guess we'll see you around soon. Say bye.
Thanks.
In the spirit of Evola Day, good to see you, meet you.